Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum and happy Labor Day. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, our small business partners, including Gateway Marketing Cafe, a Gateway is Central Iowa's premier good food store and brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry, residential, commercial, land. Joe's been covering all of that for over 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Contact Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. And if you're in the Central Iowa area, remember Birds and Bees Urban Farms got a harvest party coming up on Saturday, September 13th from 2 p.m. till 5 p.m. Hey, we'll see where this discussion goes, but a very provocative piece was written by a guy named Chris Armitage. It's called Once They Win Elections, It's Already Too Late. He's basically saying that fascism's here, folks. Don't talk about stopping fascism. Talk about what do we do now that it's here. Interesting guy. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran. He's serving currently as a director of the physical security. I'm not sure you're even sure what that is. He also works as an independent security consultant. In addition to that, he's a published author and political commentator. And he's written things called, one of them's called Bad Cop Donut. Don't know what that's about. I like the name. It's a novel that explores the abuse of power through satire, I guess. He's also written Tyrant in a Top Hat. That's a critique of authoritarianism. It's wrapped, as he says, in a psychological fiction. So he wrote a very provocative piece, again, called Once They Win Elections, It's Already Too Late. First posted on a friend of mine's Facebook page, John Muller. And it's worth a deep dive. And with me to take that deep dive is Jeffrey Weiss, the political sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College. Jeffrey, thanks for joining me.
Yep, thanks, Ed.
And first of all, happy Labor Day.
Yeah, happy Labor Day to you.
I mean, we take it's not just another day off, folks. I mean, I know Trump thinks we have too many days off, especially if it's for a cause he really doesn't believe in, ML King Day, Labor Day. But Labor Day, very important. We would not have the advances we've seen in worker safety and in worker pay and benefits if we had not seen a very vibrant labor rights movement over 100 years ago and continuing.
Yeah, or the weekend.
Yeah, or the weekend, nice. Right? Yeah. Or limitations on child labor, although we have some governors, I won't mention any by names, that want to bring back child labor. Yeah. But anyway, Jeffrey, happy Labor Day.
Yeah, happy Labor Day.
Okay, so Chris Armitage, he wrote, and I don't agree with everything he says, and I'm not convinced that we are already at fascism. And Jeffrey may disagree, but let's get started with just the opening take of his piece. He says, in 1933, German conservatives thought they could control Hitler. 2 years later, they were being executed in their own homes. I spent weeks researching this question, desperately looking for counterexamples, for hope. For any time in history where people successfully stopped fascists after they started winning elections, here's what I found. Once fascists win power democratically, they have never been removed democratically. Not once, ever. Okay, he goes on to give a couple examples where I think he proves that that's not exactly accurate, but it's a strong case, and there are lots of examples. And Germany is the first one he gives, and that's probably the one we're most familiar with. Franz von Papen, who you probably are familiar with. He was a conservative politician who had convinced the president of the Weimar Republic, Hindenburg. He convinced Hindenburg to make Hitler chancellor. Mm-hmm. And his take was, quote, "We've hired him. He's our guy. You know, we can control him." And then, of course, they couldn't control him.
The first thing I would say is I have a whole file, what is fascism? And you can look at fascism. Historians often look at fascism by looking at fascist regimes like Italy under Mussolini, like Germany under the Nazis, and then explaining their behavior and saying, this is fascism. Other people like Jason Stanley, who's a philosopher, has a book called The Uses of Fascism, where he talks about characteristics of fascism and notes that fascism doesn't have to have anything to do with gas ovens, black shirts in Italy or brown shirts in Germany. There can be attributes of fascism in Erdogan's Turkey, Orban's Hungary, and that a philosopher looks at fascism in that light. So I'm not comfortable saying that the United States is living in fascism right now, because I fear that most of the United States public's vision of that is Germany in the 1930s. And this isn't Germany in the 1930s. Now, having said that, if you read Jason Stanley's book, The Uses of Fascism, and you look at characteristics, ultra-nationalism, having an other, subversion, an enemy, absolutely. Always, you know, having your identity is based on the other. It's you see yourself through your hatred or disdain of others.
It's usually the enemy within too, right?
Absolutely. And there are a lot of those characteristics. Now, fascism has typically arisen as a way to crush strong communist and socialist parties. We don't have that in the United States.
We don't have a strong communist or socialist party.
No, we don't even have a strong working class party in the United States. Yeah. And so, you know, now, having said that, the author, I believe, is making some pretty good points that we have arrived at some level of authoritarianism right now.
And before we get into that, I want to share in more detail some of his examples. But before I even do that, what is your definition of fascism, Jeffrey?
This is why I have a whole file on it, and I really don't have...
Without reading me the whole file.
Yeah, no, it's an ultra-nationalist movement that is usually built around a cult of personality that is totalitarian in nature. I would say, that's also very vague. I would say that it would be a system that would tend to control not only the political system, but also the economic system and also civil society, so that you would have a lack of freedom of speech, a lack of a Fourth Amendment in dealing with the police. And that is something that, once again, we have not yet arrived at in the United States. But having said that, we're living under, if I had to label it, I would say semi-authoritarianism or illiberalism.
Illiberalism.
Now, part of what we're living under, we've already been here before to some extent, which was after Reconstruction, when the 14th Amendment is often called the Second Declaration of Independence. And after Reconstruction, when federal soldiers left the South and poor whites, poor African Americans and others were voting in governments and voting in mayors, and the power structure was terrified. And then Jim and Jane Crow stepped in. And the difference there was that the Republican and Democratic parties, essentially from the beginning of the 20th century up until 1965, teamed up to have majority rule oppressing a minority. Today we have a situation where it's what Levitsky and Ziblatt, two Harvard professors, called the tyranny of the minority.
Okay, so back to the definition of fascism.
Sure. Yeah.
Tell me if this is my definition. Mm-hmm. Tell me if you agree. Mm-hmm. Fascism is where corporate power and government power are identified, are united. And there is a suppression of freedom. There is a suppression of minorities. And there is a complete control by a strong, usually strong man, a central power figure who does not allow dissent.
Yeah, I would say perhaps, but where I would push back on that is if you try to describe the economy under the Nazis or the economy under Mussolini, there's a lot of labels you can give to it. So if we're going back to sort of fascist regimes of the past and saying all of them had this economic system in common, I think that's a difficult argument to make because
I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I would say there was
it's a component of it, I would say. Yeah.
But big corporations in particular, the biggest elements of the economy benefited.
Sure.
At least initially, at least ostensibly.
Well, then maybe the good news is we're not there yet because not all of our corporate classes bought into it. Now, having said that, it's clear that Mr. Bezos, Mr. Zuckerberg, and the other people who, you know, stood at the president's side during the inauguration, it's clear that we do have a significant corporate class that loves money more than freedom, that loves money more than the idea of living in a free society. That appears to be clear, and that is one of the things that was unveiled in this second term that wasn't necessarily unveiled in the first term.
So let's go back to Armitage's piece. And let me just share with you four examples he gives of fascism. And again, his premise is that fascism has already arrived in the U.S., and he presents these four cases as examples. And he says he reviewed 50 cases. And he says they all came out the same way. Once fascists take power democratically, they never give it up. It's never lost democratically. It's always lost. He claims it's always lost through some kind of military response. Mm-hmm. He gives the example of Germany. Again, I shared that with you already. Where the corporate class said, okay, we're going to make Hitler chancellor. We'll control him. What could go wrong? In Italy, of course, in October of 1922, mm-hmm. Mussolini, he announced mm-hmm. he's marching on Rome. He has 30,000 black shirts. Apparently, they weren't that well armed or organized, but the Italian military, the king, rather, decided, well, let's not get into a fight with them. Let's just invite them to form a government. And boom, you have fascism for the next, 23 years. Mm-hmm. He gives the example of Spain. Mm-hmm. There was 3 years of escalating fascist violence, assassination attempts, and in 1936 Franco launched a military coup and ruled for the next 39 years. You know, closer to our time here, Hungary, Viktor Orban, you mentioned earlier, won democratically in 2010, and by 2011 he'd rewritten the constitution. By 2012 he controlled the media. By 2013 he'd gutted the judiciary, and it's 2025 and he's still in power. Hungary is now a one-party state. Now, that example, to me, seems the most relevant to what we're dealing with in the U.S., more so than Germany, more so than Italy, more so than the other examples.
Yeah, and the other one that is Turkey. And in the case of Turkey, Erdogan turned a semi-presidential republic that had parliamentary power into a presidential republic and nullified the power of the parliament and understood correctly that if you have a separation of powers or checks and balance system like the United States, you can capture the referees, meaning the executive can capture the legislative and judiciary, and you have a one-party state, and you can rule as a one-party state. Turkey's another good one. Where I would say that Germany, he also mentions France, didn't go fascist in 1934. He mentions Portugal. He mentions Italy. Where these are very different is that in the late 19th century, the German conservatives, the traditional conservatives, and the sort of the military and the business class in Europe was terrified about the idea of the franchise, of giving the vote to working people. They were scared to death of that. And so in the background of their supporting fascism was their fear of what working class people would do with the vote.
Fear of democracy.
Exactly. Yeah. Remember, Aristotle famously said, that democracy, would be a catastrophe because, the poor would rule the rich.
Was that Aristotle or Plato?
Well, Plato also hated democracy. Yeah, I mean, if you look at most people who form government through history were political philosophers. I mean, they're terrified of the idea of the demos, the people, you know, and the fear of democracy. And so in also in those European countries, there was not only the fear of giving working people the vote, which is also the same thing in the United States with Jim and Jane Crow coming down south and taking away the vote. So you have a parallel there. But you have a situation where there's these socialist and communist parties. I mean, people forget sometimes that the Nazis in the cities in the late 1919 and into the 1920s were fighting with the communists, that those were two really kind of a far left party and a far right party were sparring with one another. There's this famous Jason Stanley talks about this in the hospitals in Germany in the cities would say that, you know, we could tell the communists and the Nazis, the communists would have stilettos in their hearts and the Nazis would have welts on their heads. You know, you don't really want to fight fascists because fascists kill, you know, and okay. This is a hard thing that working people and liberal people have had, we just don't kill.
And I think Armitage argues that you have to fight them physically. And before we discuss whether he's right about that, I want to present his case. But before we do that, before we go to a short break, I do want to at least present the two cases. I mean, he says at the beginning of his piece, there are zero times in which fascism has been stopped once it gained power democratically. But then he goes on to give the example of Finland. In 1932, there was the Lapua movement. I'm not quite sure how to say it. A movement that was the Trident armed coup. Before they'd secured government power, they tried the military option before going the democratic option. The military stayed loyal to democracy, crushed the rebellion, and banned the movement. And he concedes that's a success story. Then he talks about France, too. In 1934, mm-hmm. fascists tried to storm parliament. And here's what I'm really intrigued by. 6 days later, 12 million French workers mm-hmm. went on strike. Again, here, celebrating Labor Day in the U.S. this week, and happy to know that around the world, there are lots of cases where labor has prevailed. So 12 million people went on strike, and the entire country stopped. No trains, no factories, no shops, nothing. The fascists backed down. Of course, they kind of came to power when Nazi Germany took over as part of Vichy France, but that's a different story. Those are examples, in my mind, where he's wrong that there are countries that push back against fascism, and in one case through a general strike, in another case through you know crushing the rebellion with the Finnish military. So
yeah,
I mean, I mean,
what I would say is that when you have an authoritarian leader who's a demagogue, the key is for the political party that individual leads to push back. When they have a chance to impeach them and remove them from office, they do so. When they see that somebody has not accepted the results of a democratic election, which is really just a basic tenet that you have to respect the results of a peaceful election and you have to have a peaceful, relinquish power peacefully. This is a fundamental tenet of democracy. So when a political party is no longer there, you know, and so in these particular cases, the conservative or the right wing or the center right in these countries were loyal to the idea of some republic above the ideals of the far right or fascist movement. And they were able to stop it in Finland and Paris before it consolidated power. So in some sense, maybe his argument is still fairly solid in that in all these other cases, it was able to consolidate the authoritarianism.
I want to take a short break, Jeffrey. When we come back, let's get back to Chris Armitage's piece and start with his take on the situation in the U.S. now. And now that we've had a look at the history of other countries. Folks, we're talking about Chris Armitage's piece, Once They Win Elections, It's Already Too Late. Jeffrey Weiss is with me. We'll be back in a minute after a short break here on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks, with Jeffrey Weiss. Hey, thanks to our partners and our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM focuses on nuclear disarmament, the war between Israel and Hamas, the war in Ukraine, and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Western Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in both English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry. All right, Jeffrey, let's continue our conversation here about Chris Armitage's piece regarding his contention that for those who are concerned about fascism in the U.S., fascism's already here. Stop pretending we can stop it. What do we do about it now? We've been reviewing the examples he's given about fascist governments in other countries currently and in the recent past. But I want to read this one paragraph and then talk about what the face of fascism looks like here in the U.S. He says, quote, "Here's the part that breaks your heart. Violence works for them. Fascists use violence while claiming to be victims. They create chaos that requires their authoritarian solution. Then they purge anyone who opposes them. Meanwhile, Democrats, and with a small d, keep insisting on following rules that fascists completely ignore. They file lawsuits, they write editorials, they vote on resolutions, and fascists just laugh and keep consolidating power." Okay, and he goes on to say that most fascist regimes were removed by war or military coups, and tens of millions of people died in the process. Then he gives a few options. But before we look at those options, his take on the U.S., he says we've already missed our chance. The window isn't closing, it's closed. He says the U.S. Supreme Court declared Trump above the law. He's threatening to arrest political opponents. He's already sent the FBI after elected officials when they haven't committed crimes. Congress is his. Most state governments are his. Billionaire oligarchs all openly coordinate with him, as you noted earlier, Jeffrey. The window slammed shut. So let's stop pretending that the U.S. is in the, quote, prevention phase and start talking about what to do when fascists already control the institutions but haven't fully consolidated power yet. Because historically, nobody's been here before, not like this. And he's right there, because all the examples we discussed, you know, not one of those countries, Germany, Italy, Spain, Portugal, even Hungary, Turkey, none of them were extremely wealthy in a global sense. None of them possessed nuclear weapons, let alone, 7,000 nuclear weapons? None of them were the world's reserve currency. And we in the U.S. have a surveillance technology capacity that, in his words, quote, would make the Stasi weep with envy. Yeah. You know, we are in a unique position. So the two questions here are, is he right? Is the door already closed on stopping fascism? And what does it look like given all the ways in which we are very, very different than any country that has experienced this before?
Yeah, I would say no, because I wouldn't call it fascism. No, I wouldn't. I mean, for one, I wouldn't call it fascism. And two, I would say no, the window's not entirely shut. And we will see what happens in 2026. What I mean by that is there's an attempt by the majority party right now to rig the House of Representatives elections by gerrymandering. And if they are successful, I think we're probably closer to what the author is writing about. If they're not successful and there is oversight in the House of Representatives, there will be numerous grounds for impeachment. I mean, just the difficult thing for the minority party will be to decide which of the 23 things will they file articles of impeachment over. And at that point, there will be a stronger opposition. However, if in fact enough states are gerrymandered to make it impossible for the Democrats to win the House of Representatives, I think they'll probably need a 6 to 10% victory nationally to win by 1 or 2 percentage points. In other words, to win enough seats to win it. But there's only probably 50 contested seats. And if the Republicans are able to gerrymander 15 to 20, so we will see. I don't think it's that conclusive per se what he's writing. However, we'll see, because we do have a few years to see what.
And I agree that the 2026 election is going to be critically important to determining whether or not Trump controls all the levers of government. I mean, you could argue he controls Congress right now. I think that's pretty clear. You don't see many Republicans in the House or Senate willing to stand up to him. In fact, some of the Democratic efforts to stand up to him are pretty lame. Chuck Schumer comes to mind as kind of the example of the epitome of lameness. But, and you're right. The effort right now is to basically rig the 2026 election so that Republicans can maintain control of the House. Because Republicans know, and Democrats know as well, that that's going to be tough. Under the current setup, with the current districts, Democrats will probably control the House by a comfortable margin. But again, with gerrymandering in what, 8 or 9 or 10 even Republican states, that doesn't matter what California does. But further than that, I mean, just today's news, Trump has said late Saturday night in a tweet. This is how we govern now, right? A tweet announcing that he would, here's the exact language. Voter ID must be a part of every single vote. Everything in caps, by the way. No exceptions. I will be doing an executive order to that end. 3 exclamation points. The U.S. president, he said that on Truth Social late on Saturday night. He also wants to ban all voting by mail, except for the very ill, however you define that, or those in military service. So basically, they're leaving no stone unturned. They want to make sure the 2026 election just doesn't happen. Any sense that we're used to.
What he's worried about in part is that his wealth has doubled since he's become president. He's worried about so much of what has taken place in the administration and through the executive branch being under a microscope. I mean, perhaps 300 million people, including probably everybody who can hear my voice, having all of their data mined by Elon Musk and his people. And, whether we're talking about identity theft, I mean, we're talking about a massive security breach that in any normal country would be not only a huge investigation, but there would be impeachments. I look at a lot of what's happened in the United States as Argentina, Brazil, the presidential republics in South America in the 70s and the 80s that went the direction of authoritarianism. Where those South American countries have an advantage is they have constitutions that are possible to change. And so the problem with our country going forward is something we talk about a lot, is that the Electoral College and the composition of the Senate already give a built-in advantage to one of our two parties, and it happens to be the one-party state we're living under. And if they're able to also rig the House of Representatives elections through gerrymandering, it means that we really don't have any branch of government where we have remotely democratic elections or the idea of one person, one vote, or every vote counting the same. And now, unlike those countries in South America, we don't have a mechanism to change the Electoral College and have a national popular vote like those four countries.
We could, but not as easily. Yeah.
Not as easily, no, because no, I mean, two-thirds, and three-fourths is such, two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, three-quarters of the states is such a high hurdle.
It is a high hurdle. But no, Armistice talks about saying Trump already is, he's already kind of, the window's closed because he's already controlling the Supreme Court, arresting political opponents, owns Congress, controls most of the state legislatures. But what he doesn't talk about is the fact that there are lots of judicial districts, especially in the appeals. The Supreme Court is kind of a problem, and I know everything eventually might maybe make its way to the Supreme Court, but there's lots of judicial actions that have come out against him.
That's true.
Most recently, I mean, there's a plane full of Guatemalan kids being, I'm not even sure where they're being shipped to, El Salvador, Guatemala, Sudan, who knows where. But the court said, no, this is not a legal action. And my understanding is that plane has not left.
Sure.
Maybe it has. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all happening while we're having this conversation. But there are court rulings that go strongly against many of his actions. He's thumbing his nose at some of them, but he can't thumb his nose at all of them yet. So I think there are still plenty of checks. I mean, the other checks and balances, you and I are having this conversation. And there are people much more, there are media people much higher up than we are in terms of how big an audience they have, who are having these conversations. I mean, South Park is, whether you like that style or not, They're so irreverent, but they are so antagonistic toward the Trump administration. And dictators hate being made fun of.
Yeah, well, and that's probably why I answered.
They're getting
that.
Away with it. They're getting
away
with it.
I don't see this as fascism. The other thing,
me too.
I would mention is that the federal courts are pushing back against executive power. The Supreme Court hasn't been well enough, to say the least. One thing to watch, though, will be the attempt by the president where he says he wants to create his own police force within the National Guard, because that could be his, they may answer to him. And also to the extent that ICE, I mean, you see these advertisements for new ICE agents, you know, protect the homeland. I mean, that's language, interesting language, the homeland. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that people under arms answer to him. And this was a concern in 2020, of course, when members of Congress went to the U.S. military and said, will you disobey unlawful orders? We don't know if the courts will save us. We don't know if the military will save us. So far, indications are not that good. I mean, if members of our military decide to go into cities like Chicago and others and face off against U.S. citizens, then we are in... And, you know, we're experiencing something we've never experienced in the history of the United States.
Well, even the military being sent to L.A. and to D.C. is unprecedented.
Yes, it is. It is. It's only a few emergency situations.
Sure.
I mean, in terms of, you know, Eisenhower to enforce desegregation down south, and Kennedy did the same thing. Nothing like this, where there is no national emergency. And what the president has been able to do is he's been able to use two things. One is declare everything a national emergency.
Right.
Number two, all of your executive orders are based on national security. You know, and these are things that presidents have used historically. They just haven't used them to that
extent. So broadly,
extent.
Right.
Broadly. And, yeah. And you know, it's interesting because the fateful Constitution, Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution that the liberals wrote, after the Kaiser fell after World War I and Weimar was created, the Nazis were able to exploit it. I didn't mean to say exploit. Essentially, it gave emergency powers to the president under certain conditions. And the Germans put that into power because they never thought somebody undemocratic would ever become president. Mm-hmm. And then von Hindenburg was a right wing and he was undemocratic. And he, of course, eventually would appoint Hitler, right. And then he would die. And the rest is, hey, we all know.
We got to run to a short break. This is Ed Fallon hosting the Fallon Forum with my guest Jeffrey Weiss, doing a deep dive into a piece by Chris Armitage regarding the question of whether or not the U.S. has already become a fascist country. He says yes. Jeffrey and I say no, not quite. And I want to look at the four options that Armitage presents as how we respond. Again, even if he's wrong and that we are, even if we're not quite fascist yet, his four options are definitely worth looking at and offer some real compelling conversations. And one of them relates very much to the option that you presented on this program and elsewhere a while back, which involved cutting the country in half along the Mississippi River with Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other. A proposal that I strongly disagree with, Jeffrey, but respect the thought piece that it is and the conversations it helps generate. We'll be back in a minute, folks, with more a deeper look at the options presented by Armitage in his piece here on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our partners, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, Jeffrey Weiss with me here, folks. Ed Fallon, your host on the Fallon Forum. We've been discussing the thought piece by Chris Armitage. And again, his background's interesting. He's a U.S. Air Force vet. He serves as a director of physical security. I don't even know what that is, but he's very much involved in military type security stuff. He's also an author, and he's written a very provocative piece called "Once They Win Elections, It's Already Too Late." And Jeffrey and I disagree with that. We don't think that the U.S. is a fascist country yet. Regardless, the options that Armitage explores for how to respond to our current situation are, I think, intriguing. The first one is what he calls the Blue State Coalition. He points out that California's economy is bigger than Great Britain. New York controls global finance, for now. The Blue States collectively represent about 60% of America's GDP, and they could theoretically make the federal government irrelevant. Imagine if these Blue States and others coordinated directly, ignoring federal mandates, creating their own interstate compacts, you know, climate policy, civil rights. What if they already started, they've already started doing this to some extent regarding, you know, climate with Trump pulling out of Paris. But what about creating a state-level cryptocurrency to avoid federal monetary control, state-funded healthcare systems that ignore federal restrictions, state-level immigration policies that simply refuse to cooperate with ICE, make the federal government have to physically enforce every single policy, stretching their resources to breaking? What's the precedent? He says the way the northern states nullified fugitive slave laws in the 1850s, or the way states are currently ignoring federal marijuana prohibition. But do this all in a coordinated and comprehensive way. Jeffrey, what do you think of his option one?
I mean, some states and cities are doing some of that already, insisting that ICE shows up with a warrant, et cetera, among other things, and that the Fourth Amendment be respected. I don't know how these states would, because government is about law. We have national laws, we have state laws, we have local laws. I don't know how the states would decide to what national laws they would nullify, what they would go with. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the infrastructure is set for federalism and it's set for national law in so many things. So I can see that maybe some of these states could cooperate more with one another. However, he also points out something, you know, pretty obvious, that these states have large economies and the red states like them and trade with them a lot. And it's a mutually beneficial relationship for these states. I mean, I don't really see you could get a trade war. I mean, that's why we have a constitution in the first place.
I mean, what about sanctions? I mean, we employ sanctions all the time in foreign relations, and now Trump is going hog wild on tariffs. I mean, tools to try to pressure countries.
You could try to do that, but it would be immediately declared unlawful because of Congress's power.
Right, and then what if California decides, okay, we're going to continue to boycott goods from, say, Alabama. I don't know. Pick your red state.
Sure.
What if they just decide to do that? I mean, at some point,
I understand what he's saying. It would just be very, very difficult to do because these companies are not going to cooperate with the government of California. These companies are not going to cooperate with, you know, they're going to have the law on their side.
Right. Okay.
They're involved in the day-to-day trade. We have a common currency. I mean, I wouldn't even go with the crypto. I can't even wrap my head around a lot of that. But we all share one currency too. So, I mean, good for him to toss that out there. I don't see that as feasible for a number of reasons.
What about option two, which he calls selective compliance and, I love this, Irish democracy? Okay, the Irish called it Irish democracy when they were under British rule, the silent, dogged resistance of millions who simply ignored laws they found illegitimate. Don't protest, don't riot, just don't comply. that's my people. and of course, half the country starved to death in the 1850s. What do you think of that? It's to me, it's very Gandhian. I mean, you know, Gandhi had this whole, I mean, people think of Gandhi and they think of civil disobedience. But, you know, there was a whole series of steps that moved toward, you know,
I don't think political violence is a solution in the United States, and I don't think political violence is a solution in many countries around the world, although I don't live in them either. And at the same time, the United States needs a lot of people on the streets. They need people resisting. We are seeing laws changing before our eyes. We're seeing new interpretations of how we live. We're seeing our freedoms being taken away. So I don't really know how we comply. You know, if we sit back, it just gets worse. So that's where that might be a solution 10 years from now.
Yeah.
But right now, probably not.
Well, I mean, it's intriguing to me. I mean, not only because it's it piggybacks on what the Irish did decades ago, centuries ago. But he goes on to say, red states need blue state money. Blue state taxes fund red state governments. And what if millions of people in blue states simultaneously decided to claim exempt on their W-4s and simply stop paying federal taxes, not as protest, but as a coordinated, quote, forgetting. Now, overwhelm the IRS, make enforcement impossible. Doctors in blue states could ignore abortion restrictions. Teachers could ignore curriculum mandates. State police could refuse to enforce federal laws, not dramatically, just incompetently. Sorry, we couldn't find them. The paperwork got lost. Our systems are down. And that's,
that would be a form of nonviolent resistance.
Yeah, and that's why...
That would put a lot of people in jail.
Well, I want to share with you what Joan Bondurant, who I think wrote the best take on, the best summary of Gandhi's strategy toward change. It's called Conquest of Violence. And there's kind of a 9-step process that's outlined. Negotiate and arbitrate. Prepare the group for direct action. Agitate. Issue an ultimatum. Economic boycott and forms of strike. Non-cooperation. Civil disobedience, 7th on the list. Again, what Gandhi is usually associated with is civil disobedience. That comes way later. 8, usurping of the functions of government. 9, parallel government. And Armitage here is already beyond all that. He's in step 8 and 9. You know, usurping the functions of government and then parallel government. And it's very... to me, the biggest question is, how would Trump in this case respond?
Well, people would be put in jail. Large numbers of people would be violating laws in red states, for example, and they
states.
Yeah, I mean, abortion, things like that.
He's talking about this happening in blue states, I think.
Okay, well, you wouldn't have to violate abortion laws in blue states because you have them. So I guess what I'm saying is, a lot of what he is proposing is nonviolent civil resistance. In terms of what might be effective, I think that everybody loves money. So ways that there could be nonviolent resistance, general strikes, ways to shut down the economy, doctors walking out. We're already going to be losing health insurance for 10 to 17 million of the most vulnerable people in the United States to give tax cuts to Soros and Bezos and Buffett, etc.
And we'll be losing food SNAP benefits.
And SNAP benefits. So we're already in a situation where these things are going to be compromised. So in terms of his idea, I can see that if this was coordinated, and it could have a dramatic effect because money talks. A lot of people would be put into jail, but because...
Well, who's going to put them in jail? The governor of California is not going to put California teachers in jail if they decide to ignore curriculum mandates.
Well,
so the federal government's going to come in and jail those teachers?
Possibly. We'll see. I mean, I guess maybe that's what the test cases are now for what is going to be the relationship in our cities and things like that. There's a lot of creative things that people could do. When you look at creative nonviolent resistance around the world, I mean, to abortion, women have done sex strikes, which, you know, are
back to the Greek island of Lesbos.
Well, there are
seriously,
ways,
yeah.
Absolutely, and it's interesting that we don't study such things, and even in countries where women are second class or third class citizens, they've used creative forms of resistance, which essentially mean bonding together and making sort of the ruling class pay for their transgressions. So, I mean, there's a lot of creative, nonviolent civil resistance that people can do in the United States and all over the world.
And I'm glad to see that he mentions that. Let me move on to his option 3, this is one you're going to like, Jeffrey. Secession. he says, we already have 2 incompatible visions of what America should be. One side wants a multi-ethnic democracy and a social safety net. The other wants a white Christian ethno-state with unlimited corporate power. These cannot exist indefinitely. What if blue states started seriously discussing secession? Not threatened as political theater, but actually planned. Constitutional conventions, referendums, negotiations for national debt division, military-based transfers, currency agreements. Yeah, the last time the states tried to leave, it caused a civil war, but that was over slavery with clearly defined geographic boundaries and 2 relatively equal economic systems. This would be the economic powerhouses leaving the welfare states. What would the red states do? Invade California? With what money?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the disillusion. Yeah, that's a Jeffersonian idea. I believe that's a conservative idea. I believe that traditional conservative idea that makes sense, and it would make both sides happy. People would no longer have to live with people they may no longer want to live with in the first place.
Yeah,
and so that would make sense. And I also push back on Armitage when he brazenly writes about these conservatives in Germany, you know, then found themselves executed. Well, no. I mean, many of them and most of them became Nazis or just became silent, you know. So people adapt to authoritarianism. It's not as if, you know, everybody gets lined up.
And then millions die.
Yeah, yeah. Or millions don't die. Or you know, it depends.
Okay, but millions die.
Yeah, yeah. Or a lot fewer people die and they just silently comply. And so, you know, that's where I'd push back on some of what he wrote about Italy and Germany. Yeah. A lot of the right wing was able to adapt to either being quiet or just becoming Nazis.
So why, I mean, he writes, the window to prevent fascism closed. And I think you and I would say, not quite closed. We need to be doing everything we can to make sure it doesn't close. And the 2026 election mm-hmm. is a pretty important part of that. He goes on to say, but the opportunity for something else, something unprecedented, might just be opening. And I agree with that. And I don't think we should wait to see whether he or us or others, or who's right about whether fascism is here or not. I think we all agree. Those of us who are paying attention agree that things are serious enough where we ought to be looking at these options.
Absolutely. And if we don't have a form of government, if we don't have a form of government, form of voting, a media ecosystem that can overcome this situation, then we really should honestly think about dissolving the presidential republic and starting over with something yeah. different.
Like that I disagree with. Yeah. Well, I think one thing we would yeah. agree on is that a military option is not on the table, especially, again, when you look at the fact that what Armitage doesn't discuss much at all is the fact that we've got 7,000 nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this would definitely be a peaceful... disillusion and
well, or
two separate countries.
Well, and again, I'm not ready to say a peaceful disillusion. I'm saying a peaceful backing away from full blown fascism. I think we can do that, and I think it has to be.
And
peaceful.
then we can all comfortably live in semi authoritarianism for decades, and our children will live under it for decades, and our children.
I don't think so.
As long as this constitution remains the same,
our form of
voting remains the same, we don't have anything. I mean, we're, what, I think 56th in the world in democracy, and we're slipping like a stone. People can go to varieties of democracy and see how far we continue to slip in terms of democracy.
Okay. Well, we this is a conversation we'll have to keep having, Jeffrey, because things will keep changing, and our, I think our opinions will continue to jive and clash at different points. I got to run to a break. When we come back, as always, we conclude this program with a discussion about farm and food issues. Kathy Burns will join me. It's our September Garden Q&A conversation. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Hitler told the world around he would tear our union down, but our union's going to break them slavery chains. And our union's going to break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky, could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down, down, down. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down.
Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Family Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program, and you're gearing up for a big event on the 13th.
We are at Birds and Bees Urban Farm. We have an annual harvest party. It's a blast. Everyone is welcome. It is our one of our major fundraisers of the year, but there's no charge for people to come. And food, fun, beverages,
like
music.
That. A fundraiser with no charge. That's good.
Yes.
It's our September Garden Q&A, and I saw a lot of beekeepers have been saying, our honey harvests are way down this year.
Yes. And
what's that about?
High heat. I will say human-caused climate change.
Kathy,
heat.
Don't you know it's a hoax? Come on.
And basically what happens is that in extreme heat, bees get busy foraging for water instead of for nectar. And they need to keep the hive hydrated, cooler, and also they can even start to drink their own honey stores to stay hydrated. And people's
put out water.
People's honey is down this year.
Yeah. I saw a question about tomatoes. A friend gave me a tomato that was labeled beefsteak at the farm store, and my tomatoes look the same and were grown from store-bought seeds. I'm not quite sure what that means.
Oh, sorry, the same store.
Oh, the same store. Oh, okay. But they don't look like beefsteaks. He's wondering why they don't look at all like beefsteaks.
Human error.
Human error.
I don't think the plant store, the farm store, intentionally sold a fraudulent tomato.
Tomato fraud.
I did look at the photo of this tomato was the same size as maybe Amish paste or something. It's not huge like a beefsteak. So sometimes in the seed packaging, a rogue, odd seed gets put in there, and sometimes they just they've got some cross pollination going on. Whoever's producing those seeds, they just don't know it.
Someone else wrote, first year with garden tomatoes and peppers in raised beds. What do we need to do for the possible frost this week? Okay, so that's from somebody up in Minnesota. Also Northeast Iowa.
Iowa and Minnesota.
We're not even close to a frost here in Central Iowa. For those who might be, what do they do?
Well, have your box or bin of old sheets and blankets ready to go. We do that, and all you need to do is just lay that sheet over the bed. It's good to have raised beds for that purpose.
Yeah, and it's hard when you've got a tomato in a cage. It depends how tall that cage is. I mean, our cages are 10 feet tall, so at some point you don't even bother. But
that's true. Yeah. And sometimes being farther off the ground helps. But also save those old political signs, those yard sign frames, because they're good to pick that sheet or blanket up off of the plants if you have a little bit.
One of the best uses of a political yard sign.
I think it's the best use.
Maybe, depending on the candidate.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a question we get every single year. What are the white creatures on my tomato plant? Well, they're really not on the plant. They're on a hornworm.
They are.
On the plant. And they're your friend.
They are your friend. That's a parasitic wasp, and it's the pupa of the parasitic wasp. And when you see that covering these little white, they look like little white beads or kind of grayish white, they will kill the worm, and then when the eggs hatch, then the new caterpillars go and they lay, or these parasitic wasps, lay their eggs on the other hornworms. And this is unusual too.
We haven't had a hornworm on our tomatoes in
years. Yeah, but we also don't have any tomatoes this year. Our tomatoes are an absolute disaster this year, like many people.
And again, that's due to high heat.
Probably.
And could have been, for some people, excessive.
And also, for us, it also might be we need better crop rotation. We don't have a lot of room. We have an eighth of an acre, something like that.
We are looking at letting a lot of our, a good number of our beds go fallow and doing cover crop this year.
One more question. Butternut squash, how do I know when they're ready?
Well, you know, they get kind of an orangey tan color. And when there's no green left on the skin and not even the little streaks in the ribs of that squash, and then look at the bottom where that squash is touching the ground or wherever hay or straw, whatever you've got it growing on, if it's turned a little bit paler in color compared to the rest, it should be about ready to pick.
Yeah, the nice thing about butternut squash is they will last a long time in the basement.
They're keepers.
Yeah. Hey, thanks to my guests today, Jeffrey Weiss, and to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dedeman, Charles Goldman, and thanks again from Kathy Burns and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks to all of our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, and Architecture by Synthesis. Thanks to our nonprofit partners as well, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. Finally, thanks to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music, and we will be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.